be a damper on that, on the growth of that particular sector there.
Interestingly, there's a case in Illinois where Jimmy John's was sued. I believe they had to pay a monetary penalty in addition to having their non-compete clause invalidated.
Oh, really?
So this doesn't just affect tech workers and engineers. This affects the bottom echelons of bottoms, not the right term.
The lower echelons.
The entry echelons of the labor market. And so Jimmy John's had a non-compete, and it previously stated employee covenants and agrees that during his or her two-year employment with the employer and for a period 2 years thereafter, he or she will not have any direct or indirect interest in or perform services for any business which derives more than 10% of its revenue from selling submarine, hero type, deli style, pita and or wrapped or rolled sandwiches, and which is located within 3 miles of pretty much any Jimmy John's.
I mean, that's crazy considering that if you are working at a Jimmy John's, I mean, most likely if you're going to be moving, you know, laterally, you're going
right.
to be qualified for that type of position elsewhere. It's not
right.
like there's trade secrets that Jimmy John's, the way they make their sandwich is different than other. I mean, like, you're not going
right.
to bring that and ruin the Jimmy John's business model because you go to Subway with it.
Exactly. And the people that have access to that sort of the secrets that they do have, they're not the workers that are making
right.
the sandwiches in the shop.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, that seems a bit out of control.
Right. And so here's the way that I look at it. If Albertsons, you know, has a deli and they want to hire somebody to work at Jimmy John's and pay them $3 or $4 more per hour to jump ship and come work for them, that is a boon to the employee. That's great for them.
Right.
They've proved their worth, and somebody else caught glimpse of that and was willing to pay for it. Why should we hold them back just for the good of Jimmy John's restaurant?
Yeah, and if it's a detriment to the employer, why is the onus on the employee to prove that they aren't hurting the employee? Shouldn't it be on the employer to prove that an employee leaving is going to be detrimental to them and then pay for the legal fees to prosecute that?
Yep. Well, I know we started a little bit late tonight. We had a couple technical difficulties in here, but
it is
now 6:31, and I'm sure the folks from Prison Pipeline are looking forward to doing their show.
Can't wait to get them in here.
Yeah, me too. So anyways, thanks for everyone for listening. We'll catch you next month on Labor Radio.
Yeah, I'm Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Nick Bubb.
Have a good night.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
The Cable Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 17th Annual Portland Zine Symposium, July 22nd and 23rd, from noon to 6 p.m. at the Apano Jam Space in Portland. The Portland Zine Symposium will feature Skillshare workshops, panels, and unique tapers focusing on self-publishing, social justice, expression, and more. Again, that's the 17th Annual Portland Zine Symposium, July 22nd and 23rd, from noon to 6 p.m. at the Apano Jam Space, 8114 Southeast Division Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Community Advisory Board will meet Thursday, July 20th at 5 p.m.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening. Coming to you from the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. Today, we're speaking with Kate Gonsalves, political director of the Oregon Justice Resource Center, about their new guidebook, Disrupting Mass Incarceration at the Local Level, A Guide to Mapping Reform. Could you tell us a bit about Oregon Justice Resource Center?
Yeah, the Oregon Justice Resource Center is a relatively young nonprofit. We are a public interest law firm. We represent currently and formerly incarcerated Oregonians, and we also work for criminal justice reform more broadly.
The reason I came by today is this new project that you've launched, this guidebook, Disrupting Mass Incarceration at the Local Level, A Guide to Mapping Reform. Tell us about a bit about that.
It really was generated out of the community. We had several people who were quite distraught after watching many of the cell phone videos of police use of force interactions that are happening nationally. And also, we had many other community advocates who were sitting at home watching documentaries like The 13th or reading Bryan Stevenson's book. And they really wanted to plug in and they wanted to do something. But because the systems of mass incarceration are so complicated, many people just didn't know quite what to do. And so we created this advocacy guide to give people a tangible way to start plugging in.
Folks listening probably are familiar with the old adage, think globally, act locally. Is that kind of the idea?
That's exactly the idea, and I think it's kind of a different approach. Many people, when they think of issues of mass incarceration, they think about either, you know, the new administration and the powers of the president, or they think of police interactions in the streets, and also they think of prisoners in jails. But the real point of this guidebook is really to focus people's attention to communities where they live, work, and hold power, and give them tangible ways to get involved, quite frankly, just in their backyard. Because although many prisoners are housed at the state level in prisons, they enter into the system at the local level. And those are a variety of different decisions made by local level actors that honestly have escaped a lot of attention, such as folks like our district attorneys, judges, city councilors. Many of these people have powers over the criminal justice system, and they're much more accessible often than trying to contact people in Washington, D.C., and they hold a lot more power here in Oregon.
The term power mapping, could you unpack that?
Sure. So I come from a long community organizing background, and the concept of power mapping is a tool that's been used by social justice organizers for generations, but it's rarely applied to criminal justice issues. The idea is really just to make a relational grid and to start charting out who holds power, who holds influence over the issue you're trying to advance. And so the reason this tool is so particularly relevant for criminal justice issues is because folks like John Paff have talked about how the system really is not a system at all. There's several different bureaucracies and organizations and agencies that are intertwined within the entire criminal justice system. And many of these different bureaucracies, you know, they have their own cultures or they don't work well with each other. And so trying to figure out this maze is a really daunting first step. And if you sit down with a group of other interested advocates and you start really drawing out where the power lies, it's really the first step towards taking action beyond just sitting at home feeling outraged. It's really the first step to really start building power by organizing.
In the guide, you use Multnomah County
as a real world example. Yeah, talk me through some of this.
Well, the guide was really a recognition of the fact that we are 5% of the world population, yet we have 25% of the world's prisoners. And that's just an absolute disgrace. And for anyone who cares about civil rights issues or claims to celebrate the life of Martin Luther King, I feel like you can't turn away from the criminal justice system and some of the inequities that are embedded in the justice system. And so mass incarceration here in Oregon really does have these really deep historical racialized roots. And so the point of the guide is really just to start drawing attention to this issue in a more constructive way that gives people an easy way to start plugging into trying to make change. And so part of the goal was really to lift up some of the local level elected officials. I'm someone who's a big fan of historians like Howard Zinn or Angela Davis, who really point out that change really rarely comes from the top down. It's a bottom up phenomenon. It comes from people getting organized collectively. And so we're at a time where, with criminal justice issues, we really need a lot more people to move beyond just outrage to start using their voice and plugging in and being very strategic in how they're doing that. What this guide draws attention to is the fact that many of the folks that are sentenced in the United States are getting funneled into the system through large urban areas with major population hubs. And I think that's such a surprising fact that has kind of escaped attention. The fact that many of these urban centers are progressive strongholds. These are politicians who run claiming to be very progressive. And, you know, I've heard many of our local elected leaders here talk about how they're outraged after watching documentaries like The 13th. But without local level pressure on these politicians, they are not given the encouragement to start moving these issues up to the top of their agendas and taking concrete action to really start reversing these trends and taking new approaches. So in order to really start getting people to put more pressure on these elected officials, who at the end of the day answer to us, we created this guide. Part of it is recognition of the fact that although the public thinks often of the police when they think of these issues, there's often a lot of powers that end up getting reified through just mundane daily decisions by other elected officials in their budget decisions, in their hiring practices, in just commonplace practices that end up just reinforcing these machines of mass incarceration. And until we start having broader buy-in by these elected officials and how they're prioritizing their funding or in their daily decision making or in their charging practices, we're not going to see broader change. And so that was kind of part of the context behind this guide.
Take me through some of the guide. In Multnomah County, who are some of the, obviously the county commission and the sheriff, and I guess the district attorney. Who else would be viewed as, who else would be part of the power map?
You know, one easy example is local school board members. I mean, how many parents have taken the time to sit down and talk with their elected school board members about the really high level of suspensions we have of kids of color? That, you know, some of these systems with the school to prison pipeline start very early on. And we've seen in area schools that kids of color are much more likely to be, you know, suspended rather than giving interventions like their white counterparts, such as counseling. And so there's starting to be a movement towards more restorative justice policies, but I think it's really up to parents to start really meeting with their school board members and putting this on their agendas and making sure that they're voicing these concerns. And, you know, you mentioned district attorneys, so I'll just elaborate on that point a bit, just because district attorneys probably have more power than any other elected actor. 85% of prosecutors run unopposed in elections. And so that's starting to change, where people are starting to hone in on the powers of the prosecutor in these charging decisions. You know, they decide whether or not they're even going to file a case at all. And so I think many Americans, you know, they watch a lot of television. And so they have these ideas of our justice system that don't really match what happens in reality. Nearly 90 to 95% of folks are getting sentenced without a trial in this country. And so we all think you have a judge and a jury, but in reality, many of these defendants are actually taking plea deals, and that's hammered out with the prosecutor. Now, I would say 79% of district attorneys in this country are white males. And what does that mean when you have a disproportionate impact on communities of color across the country? One in three black babies in this country are expected to grow up and face time in jail. So again, we have really historic roots of racialized inequality in this country that has continued to be reified, and it's continuing to create cycles of intergenerational poverty and diminished futures for these kids. And so really starting to pay more attention to the powers of our district attorneys and the drastic increase in punitive charging practices, I think, is starting to be put on the radar of many Americans. But for many, many years, I think some of these actors have really escaped attention, despite the fact that they run in our county and they represent us. These are folks who need to hear from us.
I suppose part of the problem is that the people have a presumption, well, if they've pled guilty, they must have done something, or if they, heck, even if they've been arrested and charged, that people must have done. But one thing that, well, one of the other groups that you work with, the Oregon Innocence Project, has proven is that just because someone has even been convicted doesn't mean they really committed the crime. Do we hear many cases of that in Portland area, in Multnomah, where people are basically pleading guilty to the offense just so they can get themselves out of jail?
That's definitely a piece of the puzzle here and everywhere, because when we're talking about issues of mass incarceration, we have to look at the people it's impacting most. And overwhelmingly, that's people of color, that's poor people, that's houseless individuals, that's the trans community. We have cases across the nation of people who are charged with a crime. They just want to get back to work. You know, they need to get on with their lives. And so they don't have the time to sit and wait for it to get resolved. And so sometimes people do accept plea deals. In other more serious cases, we have situations where, as a result of the passage of mandatory minimums, you know, people are terrified that they are going to be facing some really serious amounts of time in prison. And so what happens is people see their lives flash before their eyes. And so, you know, we see instances with, for example, what happened recently at Grant High School, I think, brought a lot of attention to mandatory minimums and the way prosecutors are continuing to file these types of charges. You know, you have kids that are involved in school fights, and once there used to be a different way of resolving these types of situations in the 80s. I remember when I was in school, you'd get referred to a school counselor. But now, you know, some of these youths in Oregon are facing some really hefty time. And when this was passed at the ballot, I think a lot of Oregonians mistakenly thought it was going to apply to just, you know, they have this image of, like, it's really a lot of fear mongering, right? Of, like, hardened criminals, not realizing it's going to impact their neighbors and their children. And so once, you know, we've seen the results of these damaging policies and then the ways they're used as a leverage plea deals, it's just disastrous for our communities.
You are listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Today, we're speaking with Kate Gonsalves, political director of the Oregon Justice Resource Center, about their new guidebook, Disrupting Mass Incarceration at the Local Level, A Guide to Mapping Reform. Here in Multnomah County, the county commission is moving forward with the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion LEAD program, which was pioneered up in King County. Of course, one of the, you know, the training officers is one hurdle, and the biggest hurdle is resources. How could power mapping help to keep Multnomah County focused on making LEAD work?
In addition to power mapping, the guide also really focuses in on many different actions people can take to start plugging in. And so, passing policy is only half the battle. Getting these policies implemented and ensuring that they don't turn into more net widening, but are actually decreasing the number of people entering the system, is absolutely critical. And so in order for that to work, we have to remain vigilant. And that means, you know, showing up at county commissioner meetings to testify about the importance of investing in the budget towards programs like LEAD or towards other community programs outside of the criminal justice system entirely, or, you know, continuing to have coordinated calls or write letters or seek press and continuing to honestly hold people's feet to the fire to make sure that these programs get implemented as promised and continue to make sure that they also have the support to keep going further. And so I do think, you know, these types of policies are what really makes sense in terms of a pre-booking program and its, you know, harm reduction. And so it's a really smart approach to try to do something different rather than just continually put someone in a cell and think we're going to get different results, and then having these people cycle through the system at great costs and with very little impact. But again, we just have to be really smart about how we're going about pushing back on these issues to make sure that we are getting the results that were promised. And at the end of the day, that's having less people become entwined with the system in the first place, not just a form of net widening where we're continually expanding the tentacles of the criminal justice system.
Back to the drug courts and the, oh, was that a great idea? Whoops, until it wasn't. And what kind of, you're the political director, what's OJRC doing? What kind of projects do you have going now? I mean, obviously the guidebook, but what kind of sort of public policy things are you folks working on?
Well, we were really excited to see that the Safety and Savings Act passed just this week at the legislature, and the profiling bill went forward. We also weighed in on several other bills to nudge them along and by providing testimony. But really, we are doing a local level focus. We feel like that's a piece of the puzzle that has really been missing. And so this guide is part of a multi-phase campaign where, you know, the first stage was really just raising awareness, getting the information out there. The next stage is really continuing to meet with community members and groups that have been doing this work for a long time and finding out what issues they find to be the most urgent, what they want to work on, and working together to really build a policy platform together and to make sure that there's, you know, upwards pressure on these elected officials so that they move towards reflecting the constituents they serve. Because I think although there's a lot of fear-mongering going on, we've never lived in a safer society. And so we're at a time when many people are starting to become aware of the extreme human and fiscal cost of over-incarceration, and they're ready to take new approaches. And I don't think that's reflected as strongly in our elected leaders. Here in Multnomah County, many of our electeds have started taking steps towards reducing our reliance on over-incarceration, but we really need to push them much, much further if we're going to decrease, you know, going from being, you know, 25% of prisoners in this world are in the United States. And that's happened under our watch. So everyone alive at this moment needs to really start moving beyond sitting at home, watching these videos, getting outraged, and then doing nothing. They need to start really voting. They need to start educating themselves on these issues. They need to start regularly contacting their elected officials. They need to show up to these budget hearings. They need to be a voice. And there's many different ways to plug in. And this is a particularly exciting moment. I feel like there's a lot of energy bubbling up. And here at OJRC, we just want to give people more opportunities to plug in, because it's really going to take, quite frankly, a lot more people to start giving a damn. We can't do this work alone, and the responsibility is really on all of us to start using our voice and speaking up more on these issues.
So what can listeners do? What can listeners do? How can they get involved and start doing this? I mean, it's not enough to just give things a like on Facebook. What else should people be doing?
So in the guide, we created 20 actions Oregonians can take. But part of that, I would say, is just starting to build community, come together with other individuals who want to work on these issues, get off the couch and start organizing. That's the only way systems have ever changed in this country, is individuals becoming outraged and then combining with other like-minded individuals and organizations already doing this work to really start pushing more strategically for change. And so with that, I would obviously do a shameless plug and say, please read and share the guide. We are happy to give presentations and help with power mapping. If there is a community group who has a specific justice-related issue they want to work on, we're happy to be a resource. We can't do this work alone. I think the number of people the justice system impacts compared to the number of people trying to do this work is just this huge wave, and we can't do it alone. We need more people to get engaged and get involved. And so there's many opportunities in the guide of how people can start plugging in where they live. And I think this work really is empowering, because once you use your voice, you know, the first time you testify might be a little terrifying, but after that, it becomes less so. And then you start, you know, giving your elevator pitch to, you know, folks you meet along the way. And slowly this bumps these issues up to the top of people's agendas, because elected officials start really hearing from their constituents and they say, oh, this is an issue I better get on top of. I'm getting contacted on a regular basis. And so it's amazing the power of what these small actions can really translate to. And again, taking that action locally can then bleed over to act as examples for the state to follow. If we start doing smarter things here in Multnomah County, we become an example that, you know, the sky hasn't fallen, that other district attorneys or other sheriffs or other county commissioners can start doing differently. And so it's really critical for people to start plugging in. They can connect with us online at ojrc.org to get a copy of the guide or to request a presentation. They can, you know, join our mailing list, follow us on social media just to stay up to date with some of the work we're doing here at OJRC. But that would be the first step.
Any closing thoughts? We're getting up close to the end of the show. So any closing thoughts for the listeners? Again, we're speaking with Kate Gonsalves, the political director at Oregon Justice Resource Center.
If you care about decreasing our reliance on the criminal justice system and ending systems of racialized mass incarceration, it's really upon you to take action and to no longer just sit back. We really have to come together and get organized. That's the only way these systems end up changing. And as opposed to other issue areas such as labor, such as the environmental movement, the criminal justice system does not really have the boots on the ground to really push on local elected officials to make change. So it's really going to take community members, particularly people with privilege and those who have benefited off these systems for generations, to start really getting organized. And you can start by picking up a copy of Disrupting Mass Incarceration at the local level and contacting us with your ideas and finding ways to plug in for systemic change.
Kate Gonzalez, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was a conversation with Kate Gonzalez, political director at the Oregon Justice Resource Center. You can download a copy of their new guidebook, Disrupting Mass Incarceration at the Local Level, A Guide to Mapping Reform, at their website, ojrc.org. And well, that's it for this week. You have been listening to Prison Pipeline. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Find this and previous installments of the show on the web at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Please give it a like. I want to thank my guest, Kate Gonzalez from the Oregon Justice Resource Center. A quick thank you to our engineers, Danielle Parks and Mike Fataklis, for making us sound so good. And thanks especially to you, dear listener, for joining us. You make it all worth it. I'm Doug McVeigh. Good night.
Don't you know I have faults like anyone? Sometimes I find myself alone regretting some little foolish thing, some simple thing that I've done. I'm just a soul's intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. I try so hard, so please don't let me be.